Good morning and welcome. It's a pleasure to see all of you today. My name is Matthew Byrne. I'm a judge in the 12th District Court of Appeals. The first Federalist Society Ohio Chapters Conference was held in 2017, and the conference has been held annually each year since, with the exception of last year, when the conference was slated to feature a great lineup of speakers. All of the panelists and speakers were lined up. The room was lined up. I think there had been reservations received. And of course, at almost the last minute, the conference had to be canceled like everything else last spring due to COVID. So in addition to the weighty legal debates that we'll be hearing about today, I encourage you all to join me in contributing to one more debate. Is this our fourth or fifth conference? I'm not sure. So regardless of the number, if this is the fourth or the fifth, much has happened and much has changed since our last in-person Ohio Chapters Conference in 2019. We have a new United States Supreme Court Justice. The White House and the Senate have changed parties, and today's federal court nominees are likely to hold views about judicial philosophy that are different from those of nominees during the last few years. But the big developments since our last conference don't only concern governmental personnel changes, but big national debates, which necessarily impact the law. Allegations of racist behavior by police led to both peaceful protests and violent action, increased focus on and discussion of racial justice issues, and legal debates about qualified immunity, sentencing, and more. There appears to be increased concern regarding the power of social media companies, not only in politics, but in our personal lives, with related questions about privacy, the applicability or not of the First Amendment, and even antitrust law. Debates about voting-related legislation have seen high-profile corporations taking action to punish states and have led to new discussions about corporate power. Debates about over transgenderism have led to legislative action by states and political action by activists on both sides, all against the backdrop of the Supreme Court's very significant decision in Bostock. Debates about cancel culture are ongoing and touch many areas of people's lives and the law. And, not that any of us could forget, the last year saw government intervention in the economy and churches and private lives and in the medical world to a degree that is probably truly unprecedented due to the coronavirus pandemic. And we can't forget the impact on students and schools, some of which are still closed to in-person learning. The government's response to the pandemic has opened up numerous political debates and has led to a number of significant judicial decisions, though frankly less than I expected. And right now, we have a new debate emerging about adding justices to the Supreme Court. We've even seen new arguments within the legal right, with new voices arguing that conservatives should shun classical liberalism itself, and or that constitutional originalism is somehow flawed and should be replaced with a new method. This debate was virtually unthinkable just a few years ago. All of these are big, important issues. I'm a judge, so I'm not going to weigh in on any of these debates. But I will say that it is hard not to notice that many of these developments and debates are taking place against a background of declining trust in fundamental government and other institutions in our country and within our legal system. Sometimes you see it in individual voices, sometimes in polling data, sometimes in policy proposals. But you see it, declining support for the First Amendment in polls, especially with regard to freedom of speech and of religion, questions about trials and procedure, questions about due process protections and whether they're necessary or a hindrance in certain cases, concerns about elections and voting, and more. And by the way, the decline in trust is not limited to one side. You can find declining trust on both the left and the right in this country. The Federalist Society, I submit, has a critical role to play in all of these debates, and it stands as a model of how people should debate issues. You've heard it many times. The Federalist Society, quote, is a group of conservatives and libertarians interested in the current state of the legal order. It is founded on the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. These ideas do not self-perpetuate, nor do respect for or support of the structural Constitution or constitutional rights. Lawyers and judges alike have a special responsibility, I think, to promote civic education particularly given the decline in trust in our institutions. Judges are elected in Ohio, and on the campaign trail, I was heartened last year to find that many people, ordinary people, not lawyers, do care deeply about the judiciary and the Constitution, and do really want to hear a judicial candidate's judicial philosophy, their view about their role as a judge, and their view about their role with regard to interpreting text. I talked about my commitment to originalism everywhere I went, and I was told over and over again by people who weren't lawyers that they did want to know what judges, how a judge would go about deciding a case and what they thought their role was. As a judge, I can't engage in policy debates, but I can speak to high school groups, high school students about the Constitution, to Kiwanis and Rotary clubs and other civic groups about the legal system and more. You can too, whether you're a judge or an attorney or a professor or something else, and I really do encourage you to do so. I find there is a great need and interest in hearing from people like us about those topics, and we should do more of that engagement in our communities. We cannot just do our jobs and assume that the legal system will be trusted. We have to talk to people. The fact of the matter is, just as Justice Scalia argued that originalism was not perfect, but was better than any other alternative, our constitutional system and our legal system are not perfect, but they are better than any alternative. There's a reason for that. At its heart, our Constitution is based on the acknowledgement that all people are imperfect, they cannot make themselves perfect, and when given too much power, they tend to be corrupted by it and cause all manner of problems for others. James Madison summarized this insight in Federalist 51. But what is, quote, what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. In order to control itself, each branch of government must operate within its prescribed limits, including the judiciary. The system works, but we need to constantly remind people, both within and outside government, of what that system is, of what the separation of powers means. Separation of powers requires, or at least compels, debate within government, within the legal profession, and in society. The Federal Society is one of those places where real debate still takes place. Since its founding by law students in the 1980s, the Federalist Society has provided a forum in which lawyers, judges, and law professors can discuss, debate, and hash out disagreements on legal issues from any number of substantive areas in a substantive, thoughtful manner. In my view, the conservative legal movement, the legal profession, the judiciary, law schools, and yes, even the country itself, are better off because of the Federalist Society's commitment to debate and its commitment to our constitutional system. In other words, this organization has contributed to making this a more perfect union. So that's a long way of saying I'm very excited that we're here today, that I can hear from the panelists and speakers we'll be hearing from and learn from them. In fact, I think I need to pause to say I suspect I speak for all of us, for everybody here in this room, in saying that I'm glad we're actually here together, physically, in this room. While the numbers allowed in the room had to be limited for COVID-related reasons, though we filled up very quickly, it's just true that one of the most important functions of the Federalist Society is its events, and it's bringing people together to form new relationships, to meet each other, to get to know each other better. And it's just easier to do that here in this room as opposed to being on Zoom, though the Society has done a great job in still dealing with Zoom over the last year. So please, we're here. Take advantage of the fact that we're here in person and introduce yourself to everyone you can today. We have a great lineup of speakers who will be introduced before each panel, and it's an honor to have them all with us. But none of this can come together without the help of many people, and I'm here to express thanks to all of them. First, thank you in advance to the speakers I just mentioned and panelists. Next, thank you to this year's Conference Planning Committee, Columbus Chapter President Robert Ault, Cincinnati Chapter President Joey Ashbrook, and Cleveland Chapter President Patrick Lewis, as well as Jedediah Bressman. Can each of you please stand up? And thank you also, and especially, to the National Federalist Society Organization, in particular, Vice President and Lawyers Chapter Director Lisa Ezel, and Lawyers Chapter Assistant Director Kate Fugate, as well as all the other national staff here today. the national office, particularly Lisa and Kate, I should say, I wasn't on the planning committee this year, but I was in the past, and they are wonderful to work with and just do a great amount of work to make these events the successes that they are. So also, could you all please stand? If you see them today, please thank them in person. And finally, I want to thank, of course, the Westin Hotel for having us in this beautiful space. And thank all of you for being here. Thank you for your time and attention for these few minutes. I look forward to enjoying the conference.
Good morning. Great to see everyone in person, finally. For those of you who made a trip to be here, welcome to Columbus. My name is Robert Ault. I am president of the Columbus Lawyers Chapter, and I want to take a moment to echo Judge Burns' comments and to specifically thank both Lisa Ezell and Kate Fugate of the Federalist Society for helping us to pull off a statewide conference given the present circumstances. I don't know about all of you, but I find Zoom meetings to be a bit tedious at this point and have sorely missed real social interaction. One housekeeping note before we begin, we've been able to actually do this in person, but there are a couple of requirements. One of them is at the conclusion of the panel, we ask you to remain seated. Lunch will be served, but you will be dismissed by a member of the Westin staff, row by row. So again, please do remain seated at the conclusion of this panel. With that, I have the honor of introducing an extraordinary jurist, one whom we are proud to call our own here in Columbus. Judge Jeffrey S. Sutton has served on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit since 2003, and he has now served as chief judge for a whopping 6 days. Previously, he was State Solicitor of Ohio and a partner at Jones Day. He has argued 12 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and numerous cases in state Supreme Courts and federal courts of appeals. Judge Sutton served as a law clerk to both Justices Lewis Powell and Antonin Scalia. Apropos today's panel, Judge Sutton is author of 51 Imperfect Solutions, States and the Making of American Constitutional Law. More recently, Judge Sutton honored his old boss by co-editing a wonderful collection of Scalia's writings and speeches, The Essential Scalia. Those who have had the pleasure of hearing Judge Sutton talk about the book have inevitably heard Judge Sutton offer some of the more memorable quotes from the late Justice Scalia. Indeed, it is clear that Justice Scalia made an indelible impression on Judge Sutton, perhaps nowhere more so than in Judge Sutton's own writing. At times, Judge Sutton's opinions have a poetic flair, as in Brown versus City of Upper Arlington, which begins simply enough, "A tree once grew in Upper Arlington." But Sutton is at his best when he's extolling principles of interpretation. He has warned that, quote, "A statute is not a chameleon. Its meaning does not change from case to case." And like Scalia, Judge Sutton has been an effective proponent of neutral principles. He has cautioned against theories that allow judges to dress their own policy preference in other garb. Thus, Sutton remarked in one case, quote, "At least the arbitrariness of a coin flip leads to neutral outcomes. The same cannot be said for substantive due process. Ask yourself how often federal and state judges have used substantive due process over time to innovate new constitutional rights with which they disagreed. If history often runs in one direction on that score, that suggests the arbitrator who uses substantive due process represents a greater risk to fair interpretation than the referee who flips a coin." But make no mistake, Judge Sutton is Ohio's own. For only someone who has felt the pain of an Ohio sports fan could have penned, quote, "The risk that BH would be subject to another search is no more actual and imminent than the Chicago Cubs or, we fear, the Cleveland Indians winning the World Series." The differences between Justice Scalia and Judge Sutton are subtle, but nonetheless palpable. Justice Scalia once famously quipped, quote, "St. Paul has no such authority to license one side of a debate to fight freestyle while requiring the other to follow Marquis of Queensbury rules." Whereas Judge Sutton found in a case that, quote, "In the final analysis, it may well be true that the city did not play by the Marquess of Queensbury rules." Marquis or Marquess? Although I'm not capable of settling this important dispute for the ages, please join me in welcoming this morning's moderator, the Sixth Circuit's own highly quotable Chief Judge Sutton.
Thank you to the Marquis of the Buckeye Institute for that incredibly warm introduction, which makes me feel terrible because I wasn't going to spend a lot of time introducing my panelists. The one thing I think I can guarantee is no one is going to say today, "You're on mute." We're really excited to talk here about state constitutions, and I couldn't imagine a better panel. And in fact, two of the three panelists have jobs I've been auditioning for the last 20 years, so I'm very envious of their positions. Here's a question to start things off on state constitutions. What do these states have in common? California, Colorado, Florida, Illinois, Mississippi, Montana, Ohio, and Oklahoma. All of them have rejected the U.S. Constitution and these departments. They elect their judges. They have term and or age limits. They have a plural executive as opposed to a unitary executive, electing AGs, governors, secretary of states, and so forth. Their constitutions place process limits on their legislature, single subject rules, public purpose clauses, and the like. They place limits on agency power. They don't have deference doctrines, and they limit their legislature's capacity to delegate legislative power to an agency. Perhaps one reason for all of these differences, they also have constitutions that are much easier to amend. It takes 51% votes, and they all have direct democracy, the initiative. In fact, you can say about American constitutional history that from 1776 to 1789 to the present, it is a one-way direction of the states more and more rejecting the federal constitution's approach to organizing government. All of this makes it incredibly conspicuous that there is one area where this has not happened. And that one area where this has not happened is when it comes to construing individual rights in our 51 constitutions. That's particularly puzzling because every individual right in the federal constitution mimics, grew out of, a state constitutional guarantee. And yet the norm in the 50 state high courts, generalizing, is for the state courts to start with the assumption that what the federal constitution means, as construed by the federal courts and the U.S. Supreme Court, presumptively is what the state counterpart guarantee means. That should seem so puzzling, given the fact that when the people with a 51% vote have a choice about rejecting a federal model, they constantly reject the model, and all the more puzzling because 90% of our state court judges are elected themselves. One way to think about this is to imagine former President Abhoff in a new, future race or a prior race being asked, "Well, what do you do, President Abhoff, when you have a very difficult policy problem you've never seen before, opioids, data privacy, the pandemic?" What if the first answer President Abhoff had given in his first speech was, "Oh, I always say the same thing, and I always ask myself the same thing. What would Congress do? There is no time in Ohio history, there is no time in the history of any state in this country in which that answer would not have doomed a political career. And yet the honest answer most state court judges must give is, I ask myself, what would the US Supreme Court do with the meaning of unreasonable search and seizure, a impairment of contract, a taking of property? So this great puzzle is going to be resolved and the mystery ended with our three wonderful panelists. No pressure. Despite Robert's very kind introduction, those who know me will agree with what I'm about to do, which is to say it's far better to see what people's experiences have led them to be able to say today than to list them. So I'll just say very quickly that Larry Alpoff is now with the Shoemaker Law Firm. He was a wonderful president of the Ohio Senate, and indeed for a time my son even worked for one of his assistants. He will start off for us. Justice Kennedy has been on the Ohio Supreme Court since 2012 and is really making a mark for herself within the state and within the national high courts. And Justice Bolick has been on the Arizona Supreme Court for 5.5 years. He is our out-of-state guest, so I would just make one point. The last time Clint and I were together, at least in Ohio, was defending the Ohio Vouchers Program at the outset, from the trial level in front of Judge Sadler, then a trial court judge, all the way to the Ohio Supreme Court, where we argued together, and sadly, I should point out, lost on the state constitution, the single subject rule of all things, which you'd think would make me contemptuous of these state constitutions. But of course, I'm a contrarian, and I love to surprise people. But Clint, thank you so much for being here. Thanks to all three of our wonderful panelists. We're gonna follow the conventional approach of 7 to 10 minute remarks to start, a little chance for back and forth among the three of you. I'll get the questioning started off, and there'll be plenty of time for the rest of you to join in. So, President Alpoff, start us off. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Judge Sutton, and thank you to everybody for being here today. And I'm going to reiterate what Robert all said earlier. It's great to see everybody in person. And I look forward to doing more things like this over the coming year. And it's always great anytime we have this many like-minded people, or maybe not like-minded people. One of the great things about the Federalist Society, in my experience over the years, has been that it really fosters the kind of open debate that we need as we try to lead our society into the future. On the substance of the questions, there are a few things that I'd like to talk about. First, I would have never asked what would Congress do. So any implications in the question were correct. Second, there
I didn't
is
think that was very hard.
No. there are two points that I'd like to talk about today, and I will use Kelo versus New London and a case from here in Ohio, Norwood versus Horney, as the exemplar of one of those points, which is that the state constitutions add an additional layer of protections for people's rights, an overlay on top of the federal constitution. And it's pretty common for people to conceive of the federal constitution as setting a floor for people's rights. And to give you one of the quotes from a Law Review article about this that I found instructive, one of the most widely accepted notions in American constitutional law is that the federal constitution and interpretations of that constitution by the Supreme Court of the United States set a floor for personal liberties. State courts and state legislatures cannot properly go below that floor. That's true as such, but it misses half of the story, because in each state, you then have the overlay of the state constitution, and that also sets a floor. And whether the federal constitution is here and the state constitution is here, or the federal constitution's here and the state constitution is up here, the higher of those is the floor for all the people living in that state, at least from my perspective. And I think that that's a pretty significant take on that that's missing from the discussion most of the time when I see people talk about the Constitution as setting a floor. Whichever Constitution protects more rights for the people on that particular issue is the one that you should go with. And even Kelo versus New London acknowledged this in part and said essentially, while the holding here discusses the public use requirement of the Fifth Amendment, nothing in the opinion precludes any state from placing stronger restrictions on that state's exercise of the taking power. And so here in Ohio, almost immediately thereafter, we had the Norwood litigation involving the taking of property for economic development, very similar questions to those that we saw in the Kelo case. And I had the honor of representing both the Ashbrook Center and eventual Speaker of the Ohio House, William Batchelder, in an amicus brief in that case where we took a look at the Ohio constitutional language and argued that whatever you think of Kelo, whatever the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Fifth Amendment, the language in the Ohio Constitution was stronger. And so you look at the Ohio Constitution on property rights in the very first section of the Constitution, Section 1, Article 1, paraphrases the Declaration of Independence and recognizes that all men have certain inalienable rights, but among them are life and liberty, acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and seeking and obtaining happiness and safety. And then elsewhere in the Ohio Constitution, we see language that says private property shall ever be held inviolate, and that it's subservient to the public welfare only when taken for public use. And so our argument in that brief was that putting property rights on par with life and liberty was the framers of the Ohio Constitution making it clear that it was the foremost duty of the government to secure and protect those fundamental rights. And in fact, the Ohio Supreme Court, I believe unanimously, did find that the Ohio Constitution added an additional layer of protection on top of the federal constitution, above and beyond what the federal constitution did, and they sided with the property holders in that case. So you have the situation where for individual issues, different states could have different language that goes above and beyond. But that leads us to our second question, which is, and which you can actually find in today's schedule for this panel. The second sentence says, should terms that mirror those in the U.S. Constitution be interpreted coterminously? And I think most people in this room would say, well, if the Ohio Constitution is stronger, if it provides more protection, we go with that. But what do you do if it says the exact same thing that the federal Constitution says? And then I think you have a much more challenging question because over the last 200 so years, you could have plenty of court cases at the federal level, including the U.S. Supreme Court, interpreting those provisions. And so if you're a state court interpreting an identical state provision in 2021, and the U.S. Supreme Court said something or another federal court said something interpreting the federal version of that provision in 1972 or in 2020 or, you know, way back in 1850, how much deference do you show them? Is that a definitive interpretation? And I would argue that it's not. I would suggest that if you have a state court interpreting the state provision at the time of the founding, and you have a federal court interpreting the identical federal provision at the time of the founding, those might be illustrative of what the answer to your question is. But if you are saying in 1803 or in, you know, some later year when the state constitution was amended, it was intending to adopt language from 1787 or some other time in the federal constitution, isn't the real answer, what did that language mean at the time it became part of the federal constitution? why do we necessarily want to bog ourselves down with what the later gloss put on by other courts was? So the framers of the Ohio Constitution want to take James Madison's language. I would say that perhaps following an interpretation from the Supreme Court in the mid-1970s doesn't get you there. Or certainly should not be the starting point or something that you feel you can't go beyond. And so I think, again, two interesting questions there or ways to frame the issue. First, both constitutions set a floor, but whichever is higher is the one that you go with for the people that live in that state on any individual issue. But then if you have the same language, how do you interpret it? Do you look at the original intent? Do you decide as a state matter, as an issue of first impression, or do you allow the gloss of 200 years of court decisions at the federal level to tell you what the words of your Constitution mean?
All right, thank you. Justice Kennedy.
Well, thank you to the Federalist Society, and in particular, Mr. Ault, thank you for the invitation to be here today to serve with my esteemed panelists. And I want to thank the panelists for what I hope all of you will find a very spirited and thought-provoking discussion. And thank you to all of you who are here today, taking time out of your day to be in person, and those of you who will watch and rebroadcast. You know, in leading the discussion today, President Abhoff indicated or highlighted really that concept that the United States Constitution sets the floor to which state constitutions cannot fall below. But it's state constitutions that have the ability to set a ceiling for greater protection of their rights from the overreach of government. And in my short time for my segment, I really want to highlight three concepts. First, that discussion or recognition of the dual sovereignty of the federal and state constitution. Secondly, the lack of or underdevelopment of state constitutional arguments in the future of where I think new federalism can take Ohio. You know, embedded in the very thought of new federalism is the recognition of that dual sovereignty between the federal and the state constitution. And once I think we as lawyers and judges embrace that notion, that we can actually think about those constitutional protections and the arguments about what those protections mean, and originating from two independent sources, really becomes something that we can then advance for the betterment of our citizens. It was 1993 when the Supreme Court of Ohio actually acknowledged, for the first time that I can find, that the Ohio Constitution was a document of independent force, and that was in Arnold versus Cleveland. But recently we reiterated that very concept in State versus Smith, wherein we recognized that although the United States Constitution and the Ohio Constitution might provide for the same protection, we are not bound to mirror the subsequent United States Supreme Court decision in delineating the scope of the protections that our Constitution protects. But despite these declarations and even our open invitation to lawyers to raise state constitutional arguments, a view from the bench is rarely are they raised. And when raised, it is just really a citation to the provision and nothing more, leaving us with that undeveloped argument. While there are some who have blogged and written about the justices should dig into those provisions and find something new to hang on to, it's not really the role of the court. For instance, in 1993, going back to the Arnold case, in reviewing the text and grammar of Section 4, Article 1 of the Ohio Constitution, the court recognized that the Second Amendment, that our provision actually provides greater protection in the defense of self or property. But the court really stopped short of really discussing the entire text and what that meant in overlaying the right of a municipality and creating its own ordinances and exercising the police power, instead relying on Mosser, which had been decided in 1976 They went on to say that the city of Cleveland could actually ban a particular style of weapon from being sold through exercise of a police power without really delving into the meaning of the words. If our past opinions have not set forth holdings, in my opinion, that are ground by the text, the history, or the established meaning as the foundation for that decision, then my question to you is, isn't that really leaving open future opportunities for all of you to make arguments of? When you're looking at the textual analysis, if we've fallen short or didn't do it at all. In the city of Rocky River versus the State Employment Relations Board, we actually held that stare decisis is less compelling in a constitutional context than is in common law or statutory interpretation, because you can rely on the General Assembly in common law or statutory interpretations to correct wrongly decided cases. But in a constitutional context where it's much more difficult to remedy a misinterpretation or a misstatement of what the state constitutional provision means, we are free from the tradition notion of stare decisis to correct an error in constitutional interpretation. For in the end, our oath is not to the progeny of our case law. Our oath is to the Constitution of the United States of America and the Constitution of this great state. Therefore, past precedent, construing protections enshrined in either of those documents are not in lockstep, are not carved in granite. Consequently, in my view, new arguments grounded in the text, its history, the established meaning, drawn from the text and history may yield yet a different result of those old cases. As justice, but it's still while mooring the law to an anchor, not a sail, and providing a principled analysis and guidance that others, as they advance arguments, can assert and recognize the independent force of our state constitution to fill the voids that we have left open by past court opinions. Justice Wright once wrote in a dissent in Eastwood versus Slanko, "I am heartened by the fact that although a majority of this court believes that under particular facts of this case, Slanko is not afforded any broader rights than those recognized by the United States Supreme Court under the First Amendment, it has not foreclosed the possibility that Section 11, Article 1, may afford broader rights under other circumstances. My sense of optimism is based on the premise that it is contrary to sound policy to find that Section 11, Article 1, and the First Amendment are coextensive in all cases. Such a broad holding would adopt the lockstep approach to interpretation of state constitutions. Under this approach, state Supreme Courts would interpret their respective state constitution precisely as the United States Supreme Court interprets the United States Constitution, without engaging in any independent analysis of the state constitution. State courts that follow this approach, and I quote, live with the threat that the Supreme Court, by interpreting the federal constitution, may later reverse or undermine a state's ruling on its own constitution. While the new federalism movement, in my opinion, was born out of a call for progressives to take state courts and exercise judicial activism as the liberalism of the Warren Court was replaced by the new conservative revolution marked by the Berger and Rehnquist courts, new federalism should be embraced for what it truly is, a constitutional foundation to protect individual freedom from the overreach of government through a document of independent force, our state constitution. As the Honorable Jeff Sutton once said, if 95% of all litigation occurs in state courts, then shouldn't judges and lawyers heed the call to advocacy? This is not an invitation to rewrite a constitutional provision or to engage in activism. It rather presents the opportunity to engage in a principled analysis that determines the scope of protections based on text, history, and the established meaning of our Constitution instead. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Kennedy. Justice Bullock.
Well, it is so wonderful to be here and to see so many of you in person. I think someone is going to make a lot of money by creating a sign that has the word Zoom on it in a circle with a slash right through the word Zoom to indicate a Zoom-free environment. Jeff, it's particularly wonderful to see you literally across the street from where we began our professional relationship in the Court of Common Pleas. Jeff obviously has written the book on this subject, and I, in turn, have made him wealthier beyond his wildest dreams by assigning it to my state constitutional law class.
I think you need to expand the number of people in that class.
Thank you so much to the Federalist Society for sponsoring this, to my friend Robert Ault, and it's so great to meet my two panel colleagues with whom I entirely agree. Like probably the vast majority of people in this room, I never took a course in state constitutional law. During law school, my first experience with it was in the very first school voucher case in Milwaukee, which I enlisted to defend early in my career. And that program at its inception did not include religious schools. So all of the legal theories that we had been preparing for so long were out the door, and we had no idea what legal theories would be presented. And of course, I knew nothing about the Wisconsin state constitution. And ultimately, three causes of action were alleged against that program, one of which became the major issue in that case, and it was a provision called the Private or Local Bill Clause. I had no idea what the private or local bill clause is, but basically there are many state constitutions, and essentially they say that no bill that could be a general bill may be private or local, and sometimes some exceptions are presented. So I spent the next 2 years arguing why the Milwaukee program, which was adopted as part of the state budget, was not a private or local bill. And this provision became my bete noir. I just dreamed about it every night. And along the way to ultimately a successful resolution in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, an odd thing happened to me. I fell in love with the private or local bill clause. I thought, this is an incredibly nifty clause that prevents essentially log rolling. Imagine if we had it in the US Constitution. We might not have bridges to nowhere and things of that nature that lard up our federal budget. And I vowed that this would be the only time I would ever try to limit the scope of a private or local bill clause, and that one day I would actually use it as a plaintiff's lawyer, and indeed, ultimately at the Goldwater Institute, I did exactly that. But Justice Kennedy is absolutely correct when she says that that very few lawyers do bring state constitutional claims unless there's no other option. And as a result, state courts have rarely grappled with when and how we should interpret state constitutions. I have a forthcoming law review article in the Arizona State Law Review called Principles of State Constitutional Interpretation. I have not finished it, so if anyone would like to nominate any additional principles, I am all ears. But basically, and I'm going to go over these very, very quickly, I have developed four, and I'll mention them very briefly and then conclude with an anecdote. The first is the primacy principle. And that is, when confronted with two well-developed arguments, one federal constitution and one state constitution, we should begin with the state constitutional provision. And that is because, as Jeff indicated, This is our primary source of constitutional freedoms. The U.S. Constitution and its Bill of Rights derived from those provisions in state constitutions, and as a matter of federalism, we should begin with our own state constitution. That also allows us to provide far greater stability and predictability in the law, because we don't have to follow the federal weaves in jurisprudence. And we resort then to the federal constitution only if it provides greater protections than does our state constitution. The second is the serious examination principle. And that is, and I don't know whether this is the case in Ohio, I suspect it is pretty much everywhere, but a lot of times in the early cases, our courts would say, oh, these provisions mean the same thing. And there's no analysis attached to it. In my view, stare decisis should not attach to such a superficial analysis. And when the question is presented anew, we should not consider ourselves bound unless there was a fulsome analysis conducted at the time that that decision came out that explains why it is that we follow in lockstep or adhere closely to federal precedent in interpreting our own state constitution. The third, and this harkens to something that President Abhoff said, is the originalist principle. And that is where we have state constitutional provisions that are identical to or very similar to federal constitutional principles, we should not assume that our jurisprudence would evolve in tandem with the federal jurisprudence on the subject. Rather, we can presume that there was a conscious choice to adopt identical language in our state constitution, but we should assume that it was done so with the recognition of how that provision was interpreted when we adopted it in our own constitution. And that should principally inform us as to how we should interpret our provision. And if we want to follow the federal jurisprudence, we ought to have a good reason for doing so. And finally, the independent meaning principle, and that is if the language is different in our state constitution, we should assume, and this is a matter of basic constitutional interpretation, we should assume that there is a reason why the language is different and that that difference is in turn meaningful. Why was the language chosen in our state constitution different from the federal constitution? Why was the federal provision rejected? Our job then is to determine that different meaning through the original public meaning of the words that were chosen, legislative history, and oftentimes judicial interpretations that were rendered in other states that have similar provisions, again, at the time of the adoption of our provision. Just to use an example of this, in the Cleveland voucher litigation that Jeff referred to, we looked at the Northwest Ordinance from which the Ohio Constitution was derived to understand the meaning of the words regarding the religion provisions in the Ohio Constitution, and I think properly so. This debate is on very vibrant display in a recent decision in the Arizona Supreme Court called State versus Mixton. It's a 2021 decision involving a provision of our constitution that is present in only two state constitutions, ours and Washington, from which it derives. And it is the private affairs provision of our constitution, which of course is very, very different from the Fourth Amendment. And the question presented in that case is whether a warrant was necessary for the police to obtain IP addresses and ISP data from someone who was transacting online. And by a 4-3 majority, our court ruled that the private affairs doctrine really is the same as the third party doctrine that was adopted many years later by the US Supreme Court. Essentially, I think the majority there, and you might be inferring that I dissented, which indeed I did, violated all four of the principles that I outlined just previously. This is ultimately, at the end of the day, about protecting freedom of Americans. We have the double security of two constitutions, and we cannot let one of them fall by the wayside. And I want to close with an anecdote. I was so happy to hear President Abhoff talk about the Norwood case, which was litigated by my colleagues at the Institute for Justice when I was there. And when we were developing the legal strategy to provide greater protection for private property rights against eminent domain abuses, we really faced a tremendously uphill battle, as reflected in the Kelo decision. I'm so grateful for courts like the Ohio Supreme Court that gave their own constitutions independent vitality. So for our very first case in this arena, we needed to find a case with absolutely outrageous facts and, if possible, a villain out of central casting. And we found that case in my home state of New Jersey, where a casino developer in Atlantic City said, you know what, I would like to build a parking lot for my limousines. And unfortunately, that property, and I see Jeff smiling over there, he knows how this story ends. Unfortunately, that property was owned by a little gold and silver shop, an Italian restaurant called Sabatini's. And any of you who know anyone from New Jersey knows how seriously we take our Italian restaurants. And the home of a fiery elderly widow named Vera Kogan. And the developer went to them and said, hey, I want to buy your property. And they said, it's not for sale. So he went to the city of Atlantic City and said, I need this property. I want you to use eminent domain to acquire it. And Atlantic City saying, hey, what's good for casinos is good for Atlantic City, did exactly that. And we went to court in New Jersey. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I'm very proud and happy to say that the New Jersey courts struck this taking down as violating the New Jersey state constitution. But this was one of those rare cases where it had a happy ending for everybody. Mrs. Kogan got to live out the rest of her life in the house that she had lived in for so many years. Sabatini's continued selling Italian dinners for decades after this attempted taking. And the developer was elected president of the United States. My colleagues and I were able to say, we beat Donald Trump in court. How many people get to say that? But it just underscores how important to the lives of real, everyday Americans it is, whether a criminal defendant, whether a property owner, whether a taxpayer, whether a student in a public school. The list goes on and on, and we cannot, as Justice Kennedy eloquently put it, we take an oath to our state constitutions. The federal judges do not. So we cannot outsource the interpretation of our constitutions to judges in Washington, D.C. So I'm so glad that we have this vibrant conversation going, and I look forward to your questions, to your comments, and ultimately to each and every one of you hopefully helping to develop a very, very rich jurisprudence of state constitutional law. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Bullock. That was terrific, and thanks to all of you for your initial presentation. So I think I'm going to offer a general question to start, but feel free to use it to offer second thoughts about things you already said, or particularly if you want to respond to something one of your fellow panelists said. And the general question, you know, we have a lot of practicing lawyers here, and perhaps it might be useful to talk about some ideas, tips for things that maybe have worked for the state Supreme Court justice, things you've seen where it worked, where the advocate was effective in convincing the state court to think independently and seriously about the state constitution. So I'll capture a couple that have already been mentioned. Justice Kennedy made the point that 95% of litigation in this country, civil and criminal, is in the state courts. I mean, so if you care about the rule of law, fairness, equality, it's either happening there or it's not happening. So it's hard to overstate the significance of state constitutions, because that, of course, governs and provides that second shot opportunity if you want it. Justice Kennedy also pointed out, you know, she didn't say it exactly this way, but they're referees, not players. They can't make state constitutional arguments for your clients. And it's just very strange when the lawyers, I mean, if federal law helps you, by all means, stay with the federal law. I get it. You have a client to represent. But it's the strange plaintiff who wouldn't like a second opportunity. And, you know, maybe federal law is so good you don't have to worry about it. But there's only so much they can do. And it does seem to me this is not so much a problem about state court judges as it is a problem about the law schools and the lawyers. So here are two tips I can't resist saying. Someone needs to moderate the moderator sometime. but this will just... I can't resist this because it's my next book project. So I just want to give you two ideas that I think are so great, I almost wish I could leave the bench and use them myself. One, and I'm perhaps being too optimistic about this point, but when you think of the problem of U.S. Supreme Court federal precedents dominating the discussion when it comes to individual rights and cases in state court, that shouldn't be the problem it has become. The generous thing I will say is that roughly half of US Supreme Court constitutional precedents are living constitutionalists, that's generous, and half are originalists. What does that mean for a state constitutional claim about a counterpart guarantee? Roughly half the time, the federal precedent is presumptively wrong. You can't possibly claim you are an originalist and start with a living constitutionalist Warren Court precedent is the way you should think about the Ohio or Arizona Constitution. You're either serious about your method of interpretation or you're not, or perhaps worst of all, just a fool and you don't understand any of this. But it can't possibly be the case that a living constitutionalist U.S. Supreme Court decision would orient your thinking about your own Constitution if you claim to be an originalist. The second tip, this is the best of them all because it's making a lot of lemonade out of a lot of lemons. I used to think the whole problem with state constitutional law was the law schools and the fact that they never taught state constitutional law. I'm pretty confident none of us took it in law school. This is very true, and for the most part, it is still very true. And I thought, of course, no one knows how to use state constitutions because they don't know they exist. It's not taught in the law schools. The education deficit explains why it's not argued. And then it dawned on me, no, wait a second. How is federal con law taught in every law school in the country? Let me tell you one thing a federal judge knows is how federal con law is taught. It goes something like this. Well, say for tomorrow, you're gonna read a decision, perhaps a decision by Judge Sutton. What does the students read the decision? Class the next day starts with some kind of warm-up material. Mr. Smith, what were the facts in Judge Sutton's opinion? Next, Ms. Jones, what was the holding in Judge Sutton's opinion? There it starts to get a little more debate, holdings, dicta, reasoning. This is all by way of warm-up of every federal con law class that's ever been taught. And that's to show everything Judge Sutton missed. That is the point of federal con law, to teach you all the problems with federal con law. That's why it's such a hard class. That's why it's so hard to study for the exam, because it's so hard to connect the dots. Why is that useful for state constitutional law? Because every American lawyer is already an expert on what should be avoided in construing state con law. All right, you already have the information there. It's the one set of notes from law school you should preserve and just put a new caption on the top of it, what to avoid in the state courts. Do you have any other tips? Justice Bullock, we'll start.
Those are fantastic tips, and I'm going to steal that first one from my law review article, so thank you
very
much.
Just give it credit.
I will. I'm not telling you you're not an originalist. Judge Sutton is telling you you're not an originalist. So this really is, I do think that judges, although obviously we need to have cases brought, judges do have an important responsibility, and that is to, which almost no state Supreme Courts have done, articulate the principles by which we will decide these cases. And I'll give you an illustration of why that's so important. We've had a series of cases going back now 7 decades in Arizona interpreting our state constitutional provision relating to the power of charter cities. And starting in the 1950s, the Arizona Supreme Court began developing a test, which to this day we call, we characterize as very difficult to implement. Is the charter provision that conflicts with a state law, is it a purely local concern or is it a matter of statewide concern? Very nebulous line there, and we are constantly litigating it, and the taxpayers get the opportunity to fund both sides of the litigation every time. And this line of demarcation between purely local and statewide concern is rational unless you read the actual constitutional provision, which says that charter city authority is, quote, subject to the laws of the state, end quote. About as categorical and clear as any provision I've ever seen in a constitution. So I've written 2 opinions in our last 2 cases saying that if there is a genuine conflict between state law and a charter ordinance, the state law always prevails because the charters are subject to the laws of the state. My colleagues who have continued down this road have said that is gratuitous because neither of the parties raised the constitutional issue. Well, since when is the state going to start off its argument by asking us to overrule 7 decades of jurisprudence? They're simply not going to do it. So we're in a catch-22 where we can't read the state constitutional language ourselves if a party has not asked us to do that. So it's never going to get fixed. Absent a constitutional provision. So we have to, in my mind, invite litigants by articulating principles of state constitutional interpretation to say, to tell us, without fear of appearing to have no case, what our state constitution means, and to invite us to reconsider that afresh. So I think that that we really need to, every chance we get, whether it's in a concurring opinion or in majority opinions, begin to articulate the principles of how and when we interpret state constitutional provisions.
Just one follow-up, Justice Bullock. You know, you mentioned the primacy approach, which means state courts should start with the state constitution first, and then if they don't grant relief to the claimant, move to the federal claim. How many lawyers in your experience when you've got a 2-claim case, so they've raised the Arizona Constitution, how many lawyers brief the state constitutional argument first?
Well, let's see. I think the number is approximately 0.
Yeah. That's what I was afraid. Justice Kennedy, is that your experience?
It has been. The extending an invitation to the bar to actually make those challenges, we've done multiple times in the last few years. Whether that's in a concurrence or in a footnote, or the fact that you say you've raised this argument, but short of just putting the number or the section and the article in your brief, you've done nothing else to advance that argument. I believe that if you are looking for that change, in addition to your tips, it really comes to the young practitioners that I see sitting out here. In 1991, when I started practicing law, I was doing a lot of criminal defense. I realized that that turned the world on its head for someone who was arresting individuals years before. Becoming a criminal defense attorney, I think, made me a better criminal defense attorney. But we really didn't nuance or tease out.
Justice Kennedy was a police officer early in life.
You really didn't tease out those state issues. That was not something that was being advocated at the time as it related to whether you were in law school or whether you were in with lawyers who were practicing criminal law. And I believe those organizations, the bar associations, advancing those kinds of ideas to the young practitioners to take that step and look back to say, yes, this case decided this, but there's really nothing in this case that's the anchor. It's a sale. In other words, we're just deciding X equals Y, but there's not anything related to the text, the history, whether when it's connected to the state constitution. So I think those invitations, when we have decided things that are coextensive, and I hearken back to the due process clause of the federal and the due course of law provision in Ohio, what ends up happening is they, you know, it's coextensive until you tell me why it shouldn't be. Give me the argument, advance that cause. So I do believe that the young practitioners sitting here today and those that you touch have that opportunity to advance that cause.
President Uphoff, do you want to offer tips, or I've got a follow up for you
specifically? As a practitioner, I like listening to the tips.
Well, I'll do this follow up because I suspect we share this view. It's not a great situation. I mean, separation of powers doesn't work very well if you don't have balance of power ultimately, and you could argue there is some imbalance of power when it comes to the role of the courts in American government today. Is this potentially a problem with independent state constitutionalism? In other words, by offering two shots, invigorating another court system, we're gonna take a situation where it's perhaps not ideal from a balance of power situation and make it worse. Make it more, you know, lead to activist state courts. Is there a way around that, or is that maybe just fine? It's very libertarian for sure, so maybe that would be any reason why it's just fine.
Sure. I appreciate the lead-in with the comment that it's very libertarian, because I actually had a quote that I should have used earlier that I didn't, that a member of the Ohio Supreme Court wrote in 1846. That we referenced in the Norwood brief. We should remember that the highest possible good is to be derived from a strict adherence to the Constitution and by securing to every person the full enjoyment of every constitutional right. And I think it's a tough question to answer, because if it's judges or justices who have the interpretive methodology that probably most of us have, then we would say, well, that's going to tilt in favor of protecting people's rights, that's going to tilt in favor of the individual, that's going to lead to the outcomes I like. So, of course, having a second level of review is great. And having maybe even courts that are more active in tilting things in a pro-liberty bent is great and is going to lead to the right outcome. But, of course, as you've mentioned previously, Judge Sutton, half of those decisions are not going to be decided, or maybe more than half, by people with that interpretive methodology. So I think it could become more complicated. It could become more challenging for the outcomes that you want if you have what I would consider left-leaning activist courts doing more with a methodology that I think would lead to the wrong outcomes. But if we are starting from the presumption that, you know, more of the judges than not are going to be tilting in a pro-liberty bent, are going to be protecting the individual rights, I think that the more involvement you have protecting those rights, the better. Mm-hmm.
Jeff, just a quick comment on that. Of course, state constitutionalism originated on the left. It really started with Justice Brennan's urgent plea for liberal activists to resort to state constitutions. So, as usual, conservatives and libertarians are playing catch-up. But I think that conservatives and libertarians have an advantage, and that is because even more than the federal constitution, state constitutions are charters of liberty. They have greater protections of individual rights and greater constraints on government power than exist in the federal constitution. Hence, at the end of the day, even though an originalist has to enforce all of those provisions, for example, our state constitution says that university tuition has to be as nearly free as possible. That would be a policy that liberals would favor more than conservatives, but it's one, obviously, that an originalist needs to enforce just like all others. But by and large, this really is a freedom enterprise. And at the end of the day, I think we will be very happy that we join the fray.
Well, you know, confirming your point about charters of liberty, it's really quite conspicuous to compare the 50 state constitutions and the U.S. Constitution on this in this regard. The U.S. Constitution, there are few individual liberty guarantees in the original Constitution, Bill of Attainder and Permanent Contract. Of course, most of it comes later in the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment. The state constitutions, it's Article 1 in almost every one of them. The only exceptions are these, I thought, overly lawyerly states of New Mexico and Colorado that just seem so technical to me. In Article 1, they actually lay out the longitude and latitude of the states, and I thought, wow, that's just so lawyerly, right? You don't tell anyone the rules until you've told them the place, and I thought, oh my God. And then I realized that this is actually a result of, I think, an imbibing surveyor, and so they had a dispute about the northern New Mexico border and the southern Colorado border, which ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court. So when you just place of priority, Article 1, and by the way, it's Article 2 in those two states, is all about liberty, and there are many more of those guarantees. You know, President Abhoff, you know, I think another reason people sometimes don't take state constitutions seriously is, frankly, they don't look the part. You know, they look like Napoleonic codes, and I'm afraid the Ohio Constitution fits that bill. There are very few state constitutions that, frankly, look like a constitution in the sense that they're focused on the key structure questions, the key liberty, property, rights questions. And, you know, in Ohio, we keep having these commissions. They're bipartisan commissions. They're really well represented. I know you think I'm accusing
these commissions.
I know you think I'm about to accuse you of something. I'm not. I just want you to help us, educate us. Why the commission comes up with these great, there's so many obsolete provisions. Yeah. You know, what, Korean War bonds, that does not have a lot of relevance to us today. Can we not just get these things out of there? And is there any hope for a way to make this work in Ohio?
I would really like to. I guess I was in a position where I probably could have made that happen over the last few years and really should have. And we did a lot of legwork for those types of things and just never really got them over the finish line. But I was a member of the Constitutional Modernization Commission that met over the last decade, and that was created by legislation passed by then Speaker Batchelder. And it's really astounding. If anybody here hasn't taken a look at the Ohio Constitution lately, pick up a copy. It's about 10 times longer than it should be. And covers a whole host of things that really don't belong there. And from my perspective personally, and I'm sure there's plenty of room for disagreement, I think a constitution should be about 10 to 12 pages at the most. It should describe the rights of the people that can't be infringed upon, the branches of government, the various responsibilities of each of those, and then leave everything else to statute. And I think that most of us, when we think of the word constitution, that's what we perceive of. And then you open the Ohio Constitution and it's over 100 pages long, and it has addresses of specific businesses in it and all kinds of things like that can and should be done legislatively. And I think that part of that, at least with respect to Ohio, is because of the amendment process, and not all states have a process like that that is relatively easy to put things on the ballot and put them in the Constitution. But I think certainly over the last few decades, we've seen almost a cottage industry build up in Columbus, and I'm sure that this is true in other states where, frankly, there are people who like to add things to the Constitution because sometimes that's easier than trying to get a public policy win in statute, or add things to the Constitution because when you win that fight, you win it forever, instead of winning it for 2 years and then having to beat back amendments to your statute later on. And I think it's become a real problem. And I do think that when people look at the Ohio Constitution now, there could be an inclination on the part of some to take it less seriously than you would otherwise, because instead of it being this sacred document that protects the rights of the people, sets out the branches, and that's it, it's this constantly changing, amorphous 100-plus pages of, you know, minutia, really. And I think that that is a problem.
One more question, and then we're going to get questions from the audience. So be thinking and move over. Justice Kennedy wanted to respond. But what, in responding to that, I just wanted to add this to the conversation. There's commissions, and there are conventions. A wholesale way to do this is to have a convention. There's not been a successful state constitutional convention 50, 60 years. So maybe that's hopeless. Maybe that speaks very poorly of we Americans today when it comes to compromise and sorting things out. But is there a way to do this, Justice Kennedy?
Well, I was really going back to the initiative petition drive that the president's really speaking about. And as a result of that layer or that additional way to change the or amend the Ohio Constitution, you have seen since the 70s those initiatives that people want to drive, whether that's minimum wage, marijuana, those individualize what I say issues to some. And then when you look at those states that have those initiative petitions and allow that, they're suffering from the same problem. I think it was Justice Pfeiffer who actually wrote in a case that if there is no way for Ohio to stem that tide, that our Constitution will look like California's in an end, really covering all things that should be done legislatively. But as a result of a lack of policy push or inability, putting it in the Constitution seems their way to more their viewpoint into state law and not to have it stripped.
Yes, the government of California without the weather of California does not sound like a good situation.
Not very attractive, is it?
Justice Bolick, I mean, what do you think about this problem?
So, you know, I have to admit some guilt as I am the author of three provisions of our Constitution, none of which really appear to be organic in their nature. But I do think that in an initiative state like Arizona, you do have a great fear of a great problem with constitutional provisions that are statutes, really.
Yeah.
So I do think that we have to safeguard against that. And one possible way is, you know, a constitutional provision in Arizona requires more signatures to get it on the ballot, but once it's on the ballot, it only requires 50% plus one, which of course is not the norm for adopting a constitution. And perhaps we ought to examine those rules to make it more difficult to amend the Constitution, which I think Florida has, perhaps.
Yeah, they moved it to 60%, I think.
Yeah.
I think that, but that's the highest of the state. Most of them are 51%. Well, I think you said your wife's in the legislature?
Yes.
So is it dreamy to think you could have a constitutional convention in Arizona?
Well, I am terrified about what a constitutional convention in Arizona might look at. But, you know, so our household has a separation of powers, and the rule is.
I suspect that leads to a lot of imbalance of power.
Yes. The legislature always wins.
deference, do I say?
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Well, it'd be great to get some questions from the audience. Yes, Mr. Whalen.
Thanks for the great presentation. I have a question. I think it's for Justice Bullock, though I welcome anyone weighing in. My question is very much a non-libertarian perspective, but I think in a way that supports the general project here. So much of this discussion has seemed to look at how do we get one floor higher than the other. And one thing I like about your principle of primacy is that it enables state Supreme Court justices, even say on provisions that are identical to the federal constitution, to say, we do not interpret this state provision to mean what the feds say. We interpret it to be lower. Now, therefore, we need to go on to address the federal. Because it's fine to talk about liberties, and we're all pro-liberty in the way we understand liberties. But obviously, part of the problem has been that the left is pushing a very different understanding of liberty in so many areas. So am I right to understand that your approach has that effect? I may actually be drawing this from Judge Sutton's book.
It's very hard for you to say judge. I could just tell you just couldn't get that out
yes.
of your mouth.
Ed, I think you raise an outstanding point. And it may have the positive effect of inducing the U.S. Supreme Court to rein in its own jurisprudence. And we saw this happen recently. And involving sentences for juvenile murderers. And of course, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that they can't be put to death. And now they can't have life sentences unless there's a finding of permanent incorrigibility. And one of my colleagues and I, when implementing that, said, you know, this is absolutely nonsense and we have to do it. But the court has just, in a recent decision, reined that in, I think, appropriately. So in addition to doing that, I do think that the Supreme Court does pay attention to state courts that talk about how they would interpret rights differently. In that instance, more narrowly, or shall I say, true to the text, than the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, I just want to add, you know, one way to illustrate that point is, you know, try to do it in an even-handed way. You know, progressives would, and a progressive state court would not care for Citizens United. I mean, that would be a fair inference, not across the board, but it's not a terrible inference. And you would think an originalist, more conservative state court would not care for Roe. Okay, so that's just two data points. I'm not aware of a single state Supreme Court, left or right, that has said their free speech clause applies to speech, not money, right? I mean, that's just an easy thing to say. You would think there'd be plenty of state high courts, particularly state high courts with elected judges that would say that. I'm not aware of a single majority opinion in a state high court that rejects Roe. I am aware of four states that amended their constitution to say if Roe disappears, it's not good here. So they went that route, but you didn't even have elected state court judges.
Interesting.
There's a North Dakota decision where there's a concurrence. There's a Michigan intermediate decision, court decision where there's something along these lines. That's it. About two incredibly salient issues in American constitutional law today. So I agree completely with Mr. Whalen that it goes in both directions. And I actually think it's really helpful for the federal courts, particularly general terms. Hear what the state courts have to say about due process, particularly substantive due process. Are you for it? Are you against it? How does it work? That should inform. It's like the labs of experimentation. Mr. Flowers, General Flowers. Don't say it's on mute.
So I want to follow up on that in a more practical question. You know, not every justice is Justice Kennedy or Justice Pollock who's expressed this interest in primacy. And part of the problem we face is that the U.S. Supreme Court has set the floor so high that many judges will say, well, there's really no reason it's dicta when I address the state constitution because I'm bound by the federal constitution. So what are we, in practical terms, what's the best pitch you would make to justices or judges who aren't already there for why they should be weighing in, even when the state constitution won't use it. Maybe it's an argument that, say, a state solicitor general can make.
I think you advance the argument because of one of the first questions Judge Sutton asked, or said, one of his tips. How do you get individuals thinking about this? Which goes back to me in my experience of practicing criminal law. No one was really advancing of the mentors that I had or the Bar Association sponsoring really seminars or things about advancing this. The fact that you are advancing that, I think people are reading about it and going to the primacy argument is until we start seeing those state constitutional issues raised, whether from the AG or practicing lawyers, you have to begin somewhere. And to his point, if you look at our cases from the 70s, 60s, there isn't any text really. In Arnold, they use the grammar and the phrasing of the firearms protection language just to say they're different. But there's no real discussion of what inviolate means or anything else. So to me, that was the missed opportunity as I look back at these older cases. So I do believe that there is an avenue as the solicitor for the state of Ohio to advance those protections and weigh in cases. I think the amicus briefs that you submit to our court are incredibly helpful in really getting us to see from a perspective beyond the parties of what that looks like or how that overlays in Ohio generally. And I think the strength of amicus brief has always been that if you decide it this way, this is what it goes. But when you are actually the party to the case to actually advance that, sometimes I think you're handicapped because of where it begins. If it's not raised and preserved below, which is something that you really can't see from some of our decisions that I have read and preparing for today. But I still believe that that's the strength of this conversation. And then to go start holding those, what I marked down CLEs for our local bar associations, for the young lawyers to start looking at it like that and to start raising those arguments within the trial court setting. So I think there's a big footprint for you.
I agree with that, but you can never be sure of the outcome. We had a case a couple of years ago called Brush and Nib, which was a follow-on to the Masterpiece Bakery case involving calligraphers who refused to provide customized wedding invitations to gay couples as a result of their religious beliefs. And they raised only state constitutional and state statutory claims, much to my delight and surprise. The authoring opinion, and it was a 4-3 decision striking down Phoenix's ordinance, the authoring justice said, you know what, even though this is a state constitutional case, I'm going to nonetheless use federal precedents to resolve it, because if it satisfies the federal precedents, that means ipso facto, it will also satisfy the more protective state provisions. So even when you only raise those issues, you may get a decision that focuses on federal law. Having said that, I agree entirely with Justice Kennedy, and I think that Judge Sutton may have given you a good idea. Even so long as the issue is preserved, there is nothing that says that you have to start off your briefs with the federal constitution. And most state Supreme Court justices that I have encountered over the years would love to examine their own state constitution. And if you set it up for them, if you pay homage to the constitutional origins and that sort of thing, I think you might actually get some very nice results.
Especially when you say that by resolving it under the state constitution, you need not go any further. Your work ends here. Leaving Judge Sutton on his own, yeah. Not to get that case.
Exactly. The only thing I might add, General Flowers, is that, you know, in one sense, it's true. Public defender, criminal defense prefers the two shots, and state prosecutor, state AG, very strange to introduce the second shot, right? I mean, one's enough, right? But think about it a slightly different way. You don't want two ways to lose. You want zero ways to lose. How is that possible? Actually relying on the state constitutions. Imagine a substantive due process case. And I realize that's controversial, but you could say, we're briefing the state constitution first, and the very first thing that this opinion should say is the Ohio Constitution does not have a substantive due process clause. It doesn't even have a due process clause. And that should be made clear. Now let's get the federal taken care of. And what have you done? You can try to win on the federal ground in front of the state court, and you're now, if the state court buys into your first point and treats it first, by the way, it's not dicta if they follow the primacy approach, you're laying data points for the U.S. Supreme Court to observe to change the federal doctrine, so there's zero shots to lose. That's not bad. Yes?
I have a question about institutional legitimacy. I was thinking about when talking about the next couple of decades of state constitutions. To what extent do you think it would be helpful or not in our language of argument, thinking about the institutional legitimacy of courts, that arguably it's actually better preserved by fidelity to the people's text than it is to other considerations that are precedential?
Who wants to give that a shot?
I actually think that's true, that to give institutional legitimacy, looking at your state constitution and interpreting it for your people. But regardless of how you are as a thinker, and let's say you do use the text, the history, the established meaning, you're going back to that. Because of the way that our judges are selected, to me, having just been through a campaign, even though you're faithful and you have fidelity to that, it doesn't mean that that outcome is then relished or used to support the institution. Because if the outcome isn't as people want, then it just becomes she's just the rubber stamp of the conservatives and what the General Assembly did, instead of faithful to the institution and the meaning. Either side of that coin, I go to bed every night, I'm okay with what I've done because I believe I'm faithful to those words, to the law, to our provisions. But because of the way we're elected, I'm not sure that that builds that institutional credibility that I think people would necessarily see, because we're so divisive and divided right now. But I love exactly what you said. I think it should bolster the credibility and the integrity of the institution of the courts.
I wonder if that's a great insight into how we discuss originalism externally among the people. To borrow a line from one of these speech gentlemen on the panel, the ultimate question is who decides. Mm-hmm. So if you've got fidelity to the people's text and it's properly communicated, I would hope that that's a winning proposition.
I would hope so too.
Mr. Olerman.
Good morning, Your Honor, distinguished panelists, wonderful presentations. Just a practical question. I've heard reference to the lack of a due process clause in the Ohio Constitution, maybe some additional protection of property rights. In what other areas does the Ohio Constitution set, for example, a higher floor than the federal Constitution for the benefit of us Ohio practitioners to think about in our cases?
I know of one. You guys want to start, or anyone?
Well, in Arnold, in 1993, the Supreme Court of Ohio recognized that our protection, Article 1, Section 4, as it relates to the right to bear arms, is greater than that of the federal Constitution because of the language. And in fact, in my view, it's in two provisions. It's in Section 1 of Article 1 and in Section 4, where it's dealt with specifically. So in that relationship to Arnold, and I think to the president's case of Norwood, and I'll let him talk about that because that's a second area
Sure, and with the property rights sections that I referenced earlier, again, we saw not just similar language in the Ohio Constitution to what we have in the federal Constitution, but we also had, you know, the lead off at the very beginning of the Constitution mentioning acquiring, possessing, and protecting property and putting it on par with life and liberty. So, you know, some of these may be more subtle. In my opinion, in that instance, it wasn't very subtle. They started out the Constitution by saying, okay, let's mention this. Let's have the operative language somewhere else, but let's mention this on par with the most fundamental rights that you have.
I think also the free exercise clause under the Ohio Constitution, there's a case called Humphrey where the Ohio Supreme Court rejected the Smith test under the Ohio Constitution. So I think there are some others. Yes, David, did you, go ahead. And then maybe one behind you after that. No, so you go ahead and then you go first.
David Ryan. So in Harper versus Cleveland, that was the attorneys and from that, one of the things we of course recognized the difference between the language between that and the Bible version of the Second Amendment, and so we focused on that because we felt it was clear. And we on the Supreme Court, agreed with us. But one disappointment we had was after they established, they said that it's a fundamental right. And we said, that's the error, it's a fundamental right. Therefore, you've got to apply strict scrutiny because it's a fundamental right. Well, Supreme Court said it's a fundamental right, but they should apply on a rational basis. So two points there. You know,
I think, did Justice Douglas perhaps write the decision?
Yes.
So, it's a little frustrating. We got, you know, real thing about you do it for us, but then they said, well, let's just look at it rationally. So they upheld the Cleveland ordinance, which was, I don't think it was rational at all. Certainly would have satisfied scrutiny, There's two elements there. Is the right different, and then is the reduce level, or just the scrutiny level different? And I just wonder, either of our Supreme Court justices, would you evaluate that differently? You see those two things as different parts of the analysis of the state constitution.
Well, to me, when you read Arnold, other than announcing that text that made that general statement, it's greater protection for Ohioans. There's nothing describing what those words truly mean. What does it mean when you say are held inviolate? And then all of a sudden you just jump to the right of a municipality under another provision of the Constitution to exercise police power. There's no kind of assimilating. And without that text, I don't know how you even begin that. And then applying a test that they just choose, in my opinion, in reading Arnold, in choosing which direction they wanted to go and to get to the police power. If it, taken to its logical conclusion, if they could ban the sale of that weapon, they could ban the sale of any weapon because it was written so broadly without any end. I'm not sure I answered your question, but having—
It's your sound, like, David, it's very nice to see you. And, of course, I concur with Justice Kennedy, not knowing much about the case that she did articulate. But the closest I've come in this regard is a recent concurring opinion in a case joined by another justice arguing that under the Arizona Constitution, there should be no presumption of constitutionality attaching to governmental laws, and especially citing to the preamble of our Constitution.
And going back to Humphrey and the exercise, I would say if you read Humphrey, it gives you the actual text and actually does that analysis of what those words mean in the exercise clause in Ohio. It's one of the things I left out because of time. But this is from the opinion itself. We arrived at this conclusion based on the textual comparison of the First Amendment to Section 7 of the Ohio Bill of Rights, where the federal constitution concerns itself with laws that prohibit the free exercise of religion, The Ohio Constitution allows no law that even interferes with your rights of conscience.
Right, yeah, it includes the right to conscience, exactly. I think this will be our last question. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Melina Siebert, and I'm going to say right off the bat that the premise of my question is based upon just a lack, could be completely wrong, and Google failed me. But you have spoken quite a bit about how do we motivate litigators to bring state constitutional question. Is there an attorney fee recovery statute like there is for in section 1983 or 1988 as there is in federal, because money motivates?
No, not that I am aware of, President. You spent all those years in the General Assembly, by God.
There is not something analogous to 1983 that I'm aware of.
Before most criminal, if you're practicing law and you were court appointed as I was, and you're submitting your, what I would call the fee application process in the counties, yeah, you know, your time is covered within that. The short-sightedness or the shortcomings of the system is that we weren't even talking about what does the Ohio Constitution protect. And these conversations today and hopefully in the future will get all of them thinking about that.
And I would say come to Arizona, because we do.
You do have a fee recovery.
Yes, it is, if you vindicate an important public right, you are entitled to attorney's fees.
President, looks like you still have more work to do.
I'm retired.
Well, the question's a great one. I don't know that it drives things in the criminal side for the reason Justice Kennedy gave. But you could imagine it affecting things on the civil side, although it's not a complete answer, right? I mean, you would think at a strange attitude that says, well, there's a 1988, I'll bring a 1983 claim. If I lose that, I'm not going to bring any claim at all. I mean, it seems strange not to add the state claim at that point, but surely it's affecting things. So thank you so much to our panelists for their presentations and great dialogue and conversation. And thank you so much. And I think there's at lunch.